Grosso from Vancouver to win it for Canada! Canada came! Canada conquered! Canada gold!
Buchanan with the cross in towards Alphonso Davies! Canada's history-making moment delivered by their biggest superstar! A goal the country has been dreaming about for decades! Finally arrives!
You're listening to the Northern Football Podcast with Peter Galindo, Alexander Gonguet-Ruzic, and your host, Ben Steiner.
Welcome back into episode 126 of the Northern Football Podcast, the post-game edition of Canada advancing to the CONCACAF Nations League final with a 2-0 win over Panama on Thursday night. Make sure to follow at Northern Football, at Galindo PW, at Alex Gonguet-Ruzic, and at Ben Steiner 00, your host for this podcast. Of course, myself, Ben Steiner, alongside Alex Gonguet-Ruzic and Peter Galindo. Make sure to rate, review, subscribe on Apple, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. But Canada, 2-0 win over Panama. They're into their first final in 23 years. They play the Americans on Sunday evening. Just initial reactions to that match.
Well, for starters, we thought that that was probably going to be the, I guess, entertainment of the night. And then USA-Mexico happens, which gives us everything and then some. But it was a professional performance, you know, and one that when you look at the World Cup, and the big takeaway was, can they have that killer instinct in both boxes? Can they produce those clinical moments when they need to? And sure, it's just the semifinal against Panama, but Panama's a difficult side to play against. I think we found that out for the first 60 odd minutes of the BMO game, and then the entirety of that game last March. They're a difficult team to play against, and the fact that they were able to get such decisive finishing in March and then in this semifinal, that's massive. And to keep a clean sheet on top of that, that just adds to it. So the fact that they're able to show that bodes well for Sunday, I think.
Look, we've spent a lot of time over the last few years talking about Canada's performances and how much they've changed as a team, especially tactically. So it's nice to look at a game like this where, look, Canada started slow. Mm-hmm. They had one of their worst second halves I've seen in a while, at least under John Herdman. And what would you be saying in the past? It's CONCACAF. You lost to Panama. Mm-hmm. You know, you learned a little. You got to start strong. You got to have good second halves. No, you're sitting here thinking they won comfortably. It was never really in doubt after that first goal. Because once they got that first goal, it was such a professional defensive performance. And the fact that they were able to still grab a second goal while they were struggling to string much together. Yeah. Just one moment of your two best players, two of the best players
they're
in the
bloody
region.
Good players.
Bloody good players, or arguably the best in the region, took over. They get you a second goal and you really get to a win without much complication. I think that shows maturity because, look, as we've seen, it's CONCACAF. Things can go wrong. You can have one bad day and teams will catch you. They're going to be up for these games. And the fact that Canada can go into matches like this now and not play their best and still win is key because, look, this was one of those where circumstances weren't necessarily in their favor, right? Like, just you can look at the camp, the shortened camp, etc.
Panama had 10 days and a friendly.
I'd say even you throw that out the window, just the fact that Canada wasn't really in that much form, right? Your best player comes into this camp fresh off an injury, doesn't even start, and Alphonso Davies, you know, a lot of your, you know, key players are also coming off injuries or coming off fitness concerns. You don't know what you're going to get from them. You know, a guy like Sam Adek could be starts. He hasn't been playing much lately. Ismail Kone's season ended nearly a month ago.
Yeah.
He was training with the, it sounded like, I want to say with CF Saint Laurent,
that's
based on the way they were talking.
Yeah,
it wasn't CF. I'm like, that old club, right?
Just kicking the ball around, staying fit, you know?
So, like, obviously, it's something where those circumstances could have hurt Canada in a must-win semifinal. So the fact they overcame it, we were watching a mature Canada team.
Yeah, and especially considering to Panama, they're not your slightly older siblings, Panama, anymore, right? Thomas Christensen has them really well drilled. They press very organized. Adalberto Carrasquilla, despite the loss, tremendous in that game, causing so many problems for Canada in that match. The fact that they were able to weather a couple of storms, get the decisive finishing, that does bode well for, I think, the mental side of it, as well as just preparing for that final on Sunday, where maybe yet again the match could be cagey. It is a final, you never know, and they might need those one or two decisive moments, right?
I think what we've seen from Canada over these last few games in Nations League, when you look back at the Honduras game, the Curaçao game, that they didn't play their best in. Sure, Honduras was a bigger margin of victory, but the Curaçao game was Peter, as you would know from being there, just like terrible conditions, like nobody really wanted to be playing that game seemingly. But they go out as they did last night and just put together a professional, mature performance and get the job done, whether that's 2-0, a greater score line. They didn't play their best, but they were able to see the result through. And I think that's sort of the next stage of this Canadian men's national team. But also USA-Mexico, that one certainly filled with drama. Both teams taking a bit of inspiration from the TST, the soccer tournament, trying to get down to 7v7 as quickly as they could. About $1 million match on the line as well in the Nations League final. Oh, so some similarities there. But that one ending 9v9, just some initial thoughts on that game.
Everything was marred by, yet again, the chant, and it got louder and louder as I think Mexican fans realized that the game was out of reach, which makes it even worse because they were weaponizing that. And look, regardless, it's a homophobic chant. No matter what context you use it in, no matter why you use it, you never want to hear it. But the fact that it was in a way being used to just stop the game early is really, really reprehensible. And CONCACAF released a statement at, by the way, 3:30 a.m. Eastern, saying that they condemn the chants. Well, if you condemn the chants, then you would actually come down harder on them than you have over the last few years. But it's CONCACAF's cash cow. Are they really going to punish their biggest moneymaker? And the answer would have to be no. And when you have people in positions of power in Mexican football, in CONCACAF, all the more reason why I don't think you're going to see anything. Like, it's a conversation we've had time and time again. It exhausts me to the point where I really don't want to talk about it, but it also bothers me to the point where I just feel implored to say something, in that this bullshit, and let's call it out for what it is, this bullshit has to stop now. And if that means taking away hosting privileges for the World Cup, never going to happen, but I'm just saying, if it involves closing down the stadium, if it involves punishing the Mexican Federation in terms of just financially, like millions of dollars, and you take that out, donate it towards LGBTQ plus charities or organizations, something like that, whatever the case is, it has to be done, because clearly what's happening right now just isn't working. And the fact that it took until about the 90th minute to actually stop the game when the chant was pretty prevalent long before that, just completely inexcusable. And honestly, CONCACAF, you're a joke for letting it happen.
What I could be interested by is, with Mexico struggling now on the pitch, whether those possibilities of actual punishment are a little more possible than they have been in the past, because they're not that only World Cup hope, if you're to rank them so highly. They're not like CONCACAF's only World Cup hope, CONCACAF's only hope in international, because Canada and the U.S. are, they've arrived, they're better at this point. And so, yeah, it's the cash cow, and they wouldn't want to necessarily punish that, but the U.S. is starting to attract fans. Canada's starting to attract fans, sure, in smaller numbers and not as sort of crazed, but I think there's more of a possibility than necessarily there has been in the past, just because Mexico isn't such an outlier as a good team in CONCACAF.
No. And I think the key now is, if the team continues to struggle, if the team is going to get outclassed by their fierce rivals, if they're going to become, which it's starting to look like now, the number three team in the region, and just in terms of overall performance and getting results and whatnot, do the fans stop showing up? Do the fans stop paying the exorbitant ticket prices? And therefore, does CONCACAF at that point end up doing something because, oh, we're not making as much money off of the American-based Mexico fans anymore? Do we now step up and start to do it? That's what I honestly think happens if it ends up going down that route.
Yeah, look, this Mexican team is a shadow of what it once was. I think we saw a glimpse of it at the World Cup, first time in over 20 years. They don't make it out of the group stages. And
yeah, forgot the quinto partido. What about the cuarto partido?
Yeah, no necesito. So they obviously they're struggling on the field. They have got legitimate questions to ask of what's going on in Liga MX and how they're exporting talent to Europe, because, you know, now Canada's got more tier one players,
which
than
is
them,
nuts,
which
by
is,
the way.
Yeah, obscene given Mexico's pedigree, Mexico's history, the amount of players that play soccer.
Their youth teams aren't even qualifying for tournaments anymore. Yeah, the under 20s missed out on the World Cup. That's absolutely unheard of.
Yeah, and they missed out on the Olympics as well.
Which never happens either.
With that loss to Guatemala, who had quite that U20 tournament looking back. So there's just all this going on the field, like just a lack of tier one players. A lot of guys are aging out. You know, there's no natural replacements, and you look off the field as well. The Federation seemingly doesn't care. You know, this sort of the chant as well mars a lot of this, and you know, it's frustrating as well just to see that these should be marquee games. These should be games worth celebrating for CONCACAF. Like, they 100%. Sold out a 70,000 seat stadium on pretty short notice in the middle of Las Vegas. You know, should have been a great crowd, should have been a great atmosphere, and instead, you know, the behavior of the fans is what stands out. There are fights in the crowd as well. You know, things are just getting thrown all over the, you know, every time there was a scrum, every time the players came anywhere close to the sides. And look, that's not, you know, what you're going to want to see from CONCACAF. It's a growing region. You want to see these sorts of games and be like, look, this is an example of the potential of CONCACAF. And instead, it just feels like even the game itself, right? Like, you think about it, it's a chance for this, you know, new look U.S. team to take on an aging Mexico team. You could think of it as like a you know, who's going to win in that regard. And then, you know, Mexico goes out there and they go down a couple goals and they're just butchering everyone. Like, that tackle on Florian Balogun was absolutely absurd for that red card, where it's like, look, this is a marquee player who's just committed to playing in CONCACAF. A guy who scored, he was top 10 in the Golden Shoe race last year in Europe. A top prospect comes first game in CONCACAF, he's getting butchered down like that. Like, that's not a good look for the Federation, for people like, oh, let's keep an eye on what's going on in CONCACAF. Oh, okay, that's what's going on, and the brawl and the rip shirts and all that. So I just think it was a bit of a black eye on CONCACAF in so many ways, because look, I'll always love the rambunctiousness of the region, you know, the chaos of playing away, that edge. We saw in Canada versus Panama, like, Richie Larea trying to take on the world and all that sort of stuff. But there's a line to be drawn. It just felt like this Mexico game crossed it off the field. Some of these tackles and fights that would be putting it on the field crossed that very high line that there is for CONCACAF. Like, it was a very high line for you to cross the line in CONCACAF, and I think they didn't. It just shows how, you know, this Mexico team is a shadow of themselves, and boy, are they lucky that they qualify automatically for the World Cup as it stands. But maybe that should be put in threat with all this, because, man, things are not looking good for them on or off the field.
It's also crazy that three times now, because it happened against Canada, happened now twice against the U.S., Mexican players have put clear hands on the throats of opponents. No discipline whatsoever for that. And that's just wild to me, especially when you have VAR in the tournament. Like, what? And also, by the way, like, I'm sure we're going to get to that, but that VAR review at the end of the Canada-Panama game, the fact it took 2 minutes to review a clear punch to the head.
Elbow to the head.
I'm like...
And punch.
Like, what, do you need to see another angle of the clear punch to the head? Oh, wait, I'm not quite sure. Like, where exactly does the hand come down? Like, no, it's not a hit to the head. Like,
he stone cold at him.
Like this isn't, you know, a when you're reviewing a clear hit to the head in hockey or football, and you're trying to see, like, okay, what's the first point of contact? No, it's a punch to the head. Like, what more do you need to see? Like, as soon as you see it on the monitor, oh, yeah, okay, that's a red card. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, for Balogun, I can just imagine him thinking, like, this would never happen if he had joined England.
Like, he's like, what the heck did I sign up for?
The look on his face when it first started happening was like, oh, okay, this is happening now. But to be fair, though, he kind of held his own. He got involved a little bit. So, you know, he's already starting to get used to the rigors of calling.
Like, to be fair, though, you get dropped into one of the biggest rivalries in the world, really. You can say Mexico, U.S. Sure, it's like, here's your welcome, gamers. Mexico, U.S. in a semifinal, like, those things always pop off. Yeah. So that's why I feel bad for him, though, because it did cross. Like, that scissor tackle on him was absurd.
Was,
and I think if this was a league play, like, we're talking, what, like, 5-10 games?
1,000% a red card, and probably a 4 or 5 game.
Like, that was 100%. Absurd. Anyways, enough about Mexico, U.S., because it was that crazy of a game.
Yeah, we had to talk about it. And they're going to be playing the winner of that game in the final. So, you know, it's worth discussing.
In Mexico, Panama in a third place match as well. Certainly something that I don't think anybody wants to play. I don't totally understand why there's a third place match in this tournament. But they'll probably sell it out, to be honest. And I'm sure we'll have more issues with that game to discuss as well, probably briefly. But getting back to Canada versus Panama and Canada's 2-0 win in that one, a question from Andy at AndyGold61. Could you explain the potential rationales for who started this evening and who surprisingly didn't? I think it just comes down to fitness and injury for a lot of those players, including Alfonso Davies.
And then just tactics as well plays a role. I think one thing that was clear with Panama is when you dive into what they do. From what I've seen going back for years, Panama just loves a double pivot. It can be a 4-4-2, or as we saw in this game, it can be more of a, you know, 3-4-3 of sorts, but the main philosophy is always there. They love a double pivot. So because of that, this is one of the rare games where Canada can get away with being a little lighter in midfield and not feel punished, as we saw at the World Cup when they tried to, you know, run out maybe the double pivot against teams of top class caliber. This game was one of those where you could get away with it. And I think given Davies's injury doubts, given Osorio ended up going somehow 89 on the weekend, fresh off of a 7-week layover, you know, Hoylett as well coming off an injury, hasn't played much lately. Those are three guys who you would have pegged starting, with, you know, the latter two to likely fill out that trio that Canada ran with last camp, and Davies, well, being Davies. So the fact that you could get away with that third midfielder, you could rest Hoylett and Osorio, and then from there, the fact that you have Sam Edakugbe there and ready to play 50, 60, 70, even though he hasn't played much lately, allows you to rest Davies. So it was just a mix of tactics allowing you to use your depth in different ways, throw a bit of a different look. And that's why, Canada, you know, threw out the look that they did. And they also did try some things, right? Like, I like the Jonathan David in a bit of a free role, just because he's played that role. It was a bit of a throwback, right, for those who watched him at Ghent, seeing right. Jonathan David playing a little deeper, playing as that 10, helping link things together. And you're allowed to do that thanks to your depth and thanks to, the Panama not being so heavy in midfield. So both of those circumstances certainly played a big role.
And from Jordan SC at SJordan1988, was that first 15 minutes after halftime concerning? Panama looked like they had the advantage in midfield. They look more capable playing with the ball when they're not trying to foul us like they're the 1980 Boston Celtics.
Yeah, I think it was a bit of a surprise, and that's why in the second half you saw Herdman turn to the midfield trio again by bringing in Jonathan Osorio, and that's something you could see. Because, while Canada was able to hold their own defensively with the double pivot, you lose so much on the ball when you're asking your two midfielders to defend in a double pivot and then go forward. And I think we kind of saw Eustachio and Kone run out of a bit of juice in that regard, you know, especially a guy like Kone who hasn't played as much. He was, you know, solid in the first half. He grew. He was starting to progress. And I think in the second half, his legs kind of gave out on him a bit. So by bringing in Osorio, it helped that. So, look, that was, something where Panama's freshness, having been in camp, they're a team that can hold on to the ball. Like, it's not something that, you know, people might be used to seeing, because it's not the Panama of old. But this Panama team, they outpossessed Canada both times they played them in World Cup qualifiers. They're a team that typically averages 55% possession in most games, bar when they played Argentina.
Their PPDA is elite as well. Like, yeah, the Argentina game's always going to be the anomaly, of course.
The outlier. So, like, this Panama team can hold the ball. So I think it was one where they grew in the game, and I think Canada had to respond by putting in a midfield trio, and I think they were smart to do so when they did, because it was the Alphonso Davies and Jonathan Osorio sub kind of really allowed them to go back to that 3-5-2, and that's where they really shut down the game from that point on. Like, it wasn't a pretty finish from Canada, far from it. It was scrappy, but I think at that point when Osorio came in, it did really close and quiet out the game. And again, credit has to be given to Panama. They're not the typical team, and they're a team to watch in this weird qualifying cycle with no U.S., Mexico and Canada. I think they're arguably probably the favorites, just because Costa Rica, they're such a weird place with how the age of their squad, Honduras as well. It's pretty much Panama, El Salvador, and which of a Curacao or is Suriname, or which one of those like teams with potential, Jamaica, or Jamaica can grab that potential. But in terms of teams now who I'd be betting on, I'd be betting on Panama in that World Cup qualifiers.
And from Moody's ratings at Hank_Moody12, both teams were overhitting passes, especially in the first half, possibly due to the ball or the temp control at Allegiant Stadium. Any thoughts? Possibly the ball, because they hadn't played with that ball before. But
the
also
surface probably as well. I think the playing surface probably had an impact. I would also say just the overall match fitness of the players too would have had an impact as well, because you also have to consider that some of the injured players returning, or guys who maybe haven't had as much match fitness, like Alistair, like Ismail Kone, even a guy like Stefan Eustachio, who's had a really, really long season. Like, it's on both sides of the ledger, in that you've either played a lot and you're at the end of a long grueling season, or you're coming back from injury and you haven't played enough, or you've had a bit of a long layoff because your season ended early, whatever the case. So all of those things come into play, and you kind of expected there to be rust in the first half especially. And you could see that guys, I think as the game went on, especially after the first 10, 15 minutes or so, it did start to look a lot more fluid, especially when they were hitting the diagonals, they were finding the runners in behind the Panamanian defense. So I don't think that's going to be as much of an issue on Sunday, and ditto for the U.S. as well, because they'll have had time to play. Now, of course, losing Weston McKennie, losing Serginio Dest is going to mean some pretty drastic rotation, because you're now down two key midfielders. You've lost your starting right back. That means you're going to have to adjust in ways that you probably didn't foresee adjusting.
Yeah, the narrow pitch probably didn't help either. No, it just felt narrow. Like you could, in a game like this where you're already a bit rusty, the fact that, you know, both teams are able to congest space so easily by, you know, staying organized and compact makes it harder to play between those lines and to control the ball. And I think that's something Canada ran into as well. They're trying to find those pockets that just, they're not there when you're playing on a narrow field, or they're there, but you have to be hitting these inch perfect passes. And, you know, far too many times Canada overhit them, mishit them. And that's just the reality of them not being in that form that they'd like to be at this stage. And, you know, they'll just hope that this 90 minutes was enough to shake off that rust. Because, yeah, I think one thing's going to be for sure against the U.S., the tempo is going to be even higher than what Panama showed. And on a narrow field, it's going to be a lot of tackles. It's going to be a lot of chaos.
So much counter-pressing. Like, so much counter-pressing.
And that's even without Weston McKennie, who's a bit of a counter-pressing
machine himself. Literally.
And from BTC time at Catbit Coiner, has Larea proven himself to be indispensable with this Canamen team?
Yes. And what's great about Larea, and, you know, this is the thing I've noted, he can kind of play any role for you and he can do it well. Like, you can ask him to start from 45 minutes. You can ask him to go 90 because he's fit enough. You can bring him off the bench because I think he's one of those destabilizing players that, you know, comes into any game state and can kind of throw it on his head. Because, you know, there are some players who are better as starters just because when they come off that bench, they don't necessarily, it takes time for them to grow into a game, or they're not going to, you know, come in and adjust to the game. Larea, you drop him into any game. If it's chaotic, he loves the chaos. If it's a bit more slow, he's got the technical ability to slow things down. He's just kind of this versatile piece, and I'll the energy as well he brings just throws teams off their game. And I think credit has to be given to him as well, how he continually finds a way to toe the line, right? Like, yeah, there were these moments where it was 1-0, 2-0, and you're like, okay, is he going to cross that line, get a yellow or red? Watch out, his teammates are trying to calm him down. Yet he just remained cool enough in that he's pissing people off, so they're elbowing him in the head and trying to fight him and everything. And then he's just smiling there, pretending like he's almost like pretending like he's gonna try to fight someone. He's like, he knows, he's like, okay, Milan Borjan's got me, I'm just gonna keep my cool.
So, hold me back.
So like he's really, I think, matured in those sorts of ways where he just knows how to destabilize a game with his play. Like when he runs at defenders, his defending, he does all that, but I love the intangibles he brings. And for me, he's one of those guys who's indispensable. And again, what's a benefit for Herdman is you can bring him off the bench or start him, right? It's a tough decision in this game due to the injuries. Him and Buchanan both start, but there's something where, especially if Buchanan makes a move to Inter Milan, the way that Buchanan likes to play, I do like the way Buchanan starts games, whereas a guy like Larea, you can then drop him in, because Buchanan can sometimes fade. Larea can just completely take over a game, and especially imagine if you're a defender, you get 45, 60 of dealing with Buchanan's threats, and then a hungry, motivated Richie Larea comes off the bench. The fact that Herdman has that as an option, and of course starting him whenever the avenue is there, he is indispensable to this squad. He's clearly one of the best 15, 16 players on this rotation.
And I do think there's still that opportunity for him to move to a higher level as well, because when you see how good he's become in the MLS, and of course he's been arguably TFC's best player this season, most consistent at least, but there has to be a way that he can move to a higher level, because whether that's going to be at Nottingham Forest, it doesn't look like it, even though he's likely going to have to go back, but he has to move, I think, to Europe, whether that's a Belgium, like we've seen so many Canadians do, but I think he just needs to test him against some higher level opponents in a bit of a different environment just to sort of round off his game. Like, it's there in CONCACAF, but I do think that it can be significantly better as well.
Yeah, I think that'll be key to keep pace in this race, because look, playing in MLS is not hurting Rich Hulier. I think we can clearly see that over the last few years it's helped him. But it's just, look, if you're up at those wing back positions, if you're looking at Canada keeping that formation, it's you're going up against Davies, you're going up against Adekugbe, who just was with Galatasaray, and even though he won't stay, he'll still probably go to a pretty good level. You got Alistair Johnson, who's at Celtic thriving, who could play out there. You got Tejon Buchanan, who could very well be playing for Inter Milan next season. So if you're Larea, a move up as well will just help him stay in that sort of, not to say he will drop out of that conversation, but it is going to help his merit to get more of those starts, to play, to keep playing a bigger role if he's at a club where he's testing himself week in, week out, and keep him finding that sort of edge on the field. Because, MLS has certainly been good for him just getting his confidence and being able to dominate games. But sometimes that next step is going to leagues where he might not dominate as much. And how do you cope with that? Because that's also a level that Canada's going to have to face. Whereas, yeah, now they're starting to dominate teams in CONCACAF, bar, of course, the U.S. and Mexico and, any off days. But if they're going to want to take that step up, they're going to be playing tier one teams where they're not going to dominate. And that's where guys playing in tougher environments are going to step up big. And hopefully Larea can, he's gotten a taste with it with Forest once. Hopefully he can get a taste with Forest or elsewhere this summer.
And getting into our Canada versus USA CONCACAF Nations League final preview, that match coming up on Sunday at 8:30 p.m. Eastern time on One Soccer. And a question from 23CNL plus GC Champs at Toronto Maple FC 2. How do the cards affect the USMNT's game plan? McKennie is a big loss, but Dest kind of sucks, so maybe in addition by subtraction. Can we learn from the Mexico game and bait the US into red cards?
As I sort of touched on earlier, that is going to, I think, drastically change things, because Weston McKennie, even though he may not stand out in terms of his technical attributes or his overall on or off the ball quality sometimes, where he can really punish you is just the ability to read when to make certain runs, is off the ball running in general, whether that's defensively, offensively, running between the channels, between the center backs and the fullback, and just timing those runs. Like, I can't remember seeing a US game where McKennie started and he just wasn't at the center of everything when it came to just the chaos he caused in the box. So the fact that he's not going to be there, and especially considering how well he's played in some of those games against Canada, it's a massive loss for the US negatively, but also positively for Canada, because that means that there's one less person to focus on. They don't have Tyler Adams, who's injured, so that means two key midfielders aren't going to be starting. And the depth they have, at least in this camp right now, it's not to the same level. Like, Luca De La Torre is a decent player, but to the level of a Weston McKennie or the qualities that a Weston McKennie provides, no. And Yunus Musa is going to have to carry the load now, and even more of the load, because they were already down Adams for that semifinal. Sergiño Dest missing out means that it's going to be Joe Scally, possibly DeAndre Yedlin. Both of them are capable enough. Defensively, they're still not the best. Scally's probably the best option defensively, but even then, it's still not really up to snuff, so that's going to be great news for the likes of Alphonso Davies to just run at those guys and to have the space in behind. It's going to really have an impact on this final, plus the fact that they've announced Greg Berhalter. He may not even be there for the Gold Cup, let alone for this final on Sunday. That's going to add maybe another distraction as well, so who knows how that might shake out.
Yeah, the midfield one's a fascinating one, just because, again, the lack of Adams really is where the hurt lies, because I feel like, when the U.S. are at their best, it's Adams sitting deep, it's Musa, and just kind of transitioning play, and then McKennie being his late chaotic box arriver, sometimes making deeper progression, sometimes showing up in the box, kind of doing his thing. And already with no Adams, it meant sacrificing Musa a bit and having him to play in more of the holding role, which he can play. He can progress from deep areas. And McKennie was still able to play in his freer role, albeit a bit more defensive responsibility. Now with no McKennie, that puts so much pressure on a guy like Musa to kind of shoulder all the load, especially defensively. Because with no McKennie, he's going to have to defend a lot more. So that's a huge ask on a guy like Musa. So for Canada, put pressure on there, because he is a youngster. he is someone where we've seen at Valencia, he has immense on the ball qualities. He also does a good job at showing up in the box, but defensively, maybe not his forte. And because you look, if likely options to start, it's what? It's him. It's Luca De La Torre, who also is another very good number eight, but maybe not a number six. Again, there's a common theme across the board there, it appears. It's something where it's a huge loss in midfield just because of that lack of number six, and a guy like McKennie alongside Musa was enough to, weather the loss of Adams. But all of a sudden, I think that Adams loss will really be filled. Now, so that means pretty much, it's all the other options are attacking well. So you lose that side of the defensive side. As for Dest, look, it's something where it's a loss in the sense that you lose a lot going forward. He had an assist against Mexico. He always is dangerous going forward. He gave Canada a heck of a time in the game against Hamilton, although the U.S. didn't score in that match. So I think Canada will be a bit relieved that they're not having to deal with the attacking side, although defensively I don't think much changes. And I think, in fact, if Joe Scally's in there, it's probably a bit more beneficial if it's a Joe Scally versus Alphonso Davies matchup, because that's a matchup Scally's familiar with, has done actually relatively okay in from last year's matchup. So for the U.S., they'll be happy defensively that maybe they get to play Scally, although they'll miss Dest's forays going forward.
And from Northern Football Fan at Porter BC 1409, any concerns with fitness heading into the final? Lots of guys nursing small knocks. It seemed as though pretty much every Canadian player was coming back from injury in some type of way or haven't played in a while.
Yeah.
I mean, Herdman said before the tournament that they have a plan to manage minutes, but a lot of the time when you get into these situations, when you get into these moments, that those kind of go out the window. But yeah, I think you can kind of take a look at, we talked about the lineup. Davies didn't play much. He had an impact, but he didn't play much, so he'll be ready to go. Hopefully Adekubi is available. So I think those options will be there for Canada to play what's likely their best lineup.
The rotation, I think, worked a T last night, because Davies comes in, plays just under a half an hour, gets a goal, gets his feet wet, looks completely uninhibited by the hamstring injury. And so he gets some vital minutes ahead of what's going to be a crucial final. That's first and foremost. Secondary to that, everybody who you maybe had fitness concerns about, for the most part, were withdrawn early. So Alistair Johnston, Tejon Buchanan, those guys came out right around the 60th odd minute, 65th minute, right around there. And so therefore, everybody's going to be rested for that final. So it's the perfect combination of they got their match fitness, they shook off the rust, and now they're still going to be fresh enough that even with the two-day turnaround, they won't maybe be at risk completely of injury. And for a lot of these guys too, and we're still yet to find out what the Gold Cup roster is, but they might not be there for the Gold Cup, so they can maybe afford to really go that extra mile in Sunday's final as a result.
Yeah, I think it was good to see that you win a semifinal over Panama, and you look, and Alphonso Davies got just over 29 minutes off the bench. Looked very good off the bench, we'll add, for Davies, which was good to see. He looked, fresh, that hamstring. Did not look to be bothering him the way he was skipping past defenders. You get 28 for Jonathan Osorio. You get 15 for Hoylett as well. Both of those midfielders coming off injuries. You look at as well that Tejon Buchanan only went 60, which he still is recently coming off an injury of his own. Mm-hmm. Alistair Johnson had the ankle knock. He looked fine. He made some great late runs, especially around the 60th minute. So he went 70 and got 20 minutes rest, which is huge given how many minutes
he never gets rest. So
well, I think, Christian Jack threw it out on the broadcast yesterday that Johnston was top 10 in the world across all footballers in the last like 2.5 years for
that would make sense.
Minutes, which is just absurd. Yeah. So
anytime, he always went 90, always.
Well, and he was going Wednesday, Saturday, Wednesday at club, comes to Canada, would be playing 3-game windows where it's 90, 90, 90 in eight days.
Yeah.
So like, that's good that he only goes set to 70 and will be rested a bit for the final. Adekugbe also goes 60, so he's fresh in that regard. I think the fact that they were able to...
It couldn't have gone any better, honestly.
In terms of rotation, I'd say, it's pretty spot on in terms of getting guys some minutes, but also resting others and kind of towing that balance.
And from Mayan Zilberstein at Mayan Zilberst2, What do you think is something that we need to work on for the final tactically? There were a few stretches where Panama looked scary and we could have conceded, so I'm wondering what you guys think can help make sure we keep a solid shape at all times.
Yeah, I think a switch back to the 3-5-2 might make a lot of sense against the U.S., especially because, look, Canada can win the midfield battle against the U.S.
For the first time in a while.
Pretty straight up. I think at most, if Adams, McKennie, Musa is fit, you're going for a bit of a, you know, neutral, say at best for Canada. So the fact that you have a chance to qualitatively win that battle, you go for it. And control the midfield, because I think that's where Canada lost their way a bit against Panama. It's just they lacked that connector at times. And I think from there, defensively, they were really solid. Like Canada gave up 9 shots, I think it was, but only 0.48 XG. So that's a very excellent ratio. So if they keep defending like that, I think they're obviously going to have different threats, the U.S., especially out wide, Timothy Weah and Christian Pulisic, the way Weah loves to stretch defenders, whereas Pulisic loves to cut inside, and they love that cutback that we saw in that goal. Mm-hmm. Canada's going to have to be very diligent, especially with their wide players, to make sure that they're tracking Weah in particular, and then that, you know, the right-sided center back. So Alistair Johnson's going to have his hands full with Pulisic, but that is a matchup he's relished in and thrived in before. So that's going to be key. Then from there, the central center back, just make sure Valerian Balogun doesn't get free, get loose, because he might be someone who, even if he gets 10, 15 touches, he gets one in the box. I'm sure he'd love to bag his first in U.S. colors. So win that midfield battle, be wary of those. And then from there, look, try to get in behind those U.S. defenders with the speed of the wingbacks. Try to get David and Laren playing in that space between the midfielders and the defenders, and try to stay organized. So look, all of those things are done with the 3-5-2. Canada looked best in that 3-5-2 last camp, and I think the only reason we didn't see that 3-5-2 was because of what Panama brought. But I think for this U.S. game,
a bit of rotation as well.
A bit of rotation. So I think this U.S. game makes so much sense to go with that and rock and build off of what worked last camp.
And from Jacob Box at _Jacob Box, what are the key matchup positions in this Nations League final? Who do you think this gives the edge to?
Yeah, look, I mean, there's a few of them right there. I think the wingers versus Canada battle is going to be interesting, because Canada's rotations are going to have to be spot on, in particular for going up against Weah. I think so. That's going to be a lot on Alphonso Davies, assuming he starts, just because he's going to have to make sure he gets back behind the ball and is there against Weah. Because I think Johnson versus Pulisic, that's a more than capable battle. That should be, Canada should feel confident in that regard. And then from there, it's going to be the midfield. If Canada can destabilize that weakened U.S. midfield, it feels like with the narrow field as well, if Canada can grab a hold of that game, grab some control, get some more touches for Kyle Laren in particular, because David did get a few more touches playing that free role. I think that will also be huge. So I think be wary of the U.S.'s wide threat, win that midfield battle, and then from there, for Canada, try to get a guy like Kyle Laren more involved, because I think we saw it against the U.S. in that Hamilton game where Laren just needs that one touch in the box, that one moment, that one action, and he didn't really get a chance to show it off against Panama. It wasn't maybe the sort of game for Laren, and that's why he came off in the 76th minute. But I think against a U.S. team that doesn't, you know, it's going to be solid defensively, it means those quick combinations, those decisive moments are going to be key, and that's where a guy like Laren's going to kind of step up big, especially his link-up play with the guy like with David maybe dropping a bit underneath him.
And from Star at Hemalurgi, does Buchanan start on Sunday? And from Peter Zelenika at Bosno11, does Kone start on Sunday?
Well, Kone certainly, I think, starts on Sunday. You want to go for that midfield dominance. I think it's Eustachio, it's Kone, and you see, I'd say probably Hoylett between the Azorio and Hoylett in terms of fitness, but also Azorio looks fit, so actually maybe scratch. I think, honestly, you could...
I have Azorio in my 11.
I think you can make good arguments for both, right? Hoylett in a final, the vet. Osorio's played a lot of big games. I'd honestly be fine with either, but I think Kone and Eustachio are must starts. As for Buchanan, it's a tough one, because again, I think Richie Larea deserves to start a final given the form he's in. But the nice thing is about Canada's 3-5-2 with Johnston there is that if it switches to more of a 4-4-2 off the ball to limit the US's wide threats, you can get away with having a Buchanan in that wide role, not having to defend as much. Whereas, you know, Larea, you'd want him, you'd use him for his defensive capabilities. So I do wonder if we do say, maybe, for example, I mentioned being wary of Weah's threat. Do you start Leray on the left, as we've seen before, and you throw Davies a bit higher up the pitch in more of a freer wingback role? Basically, you're having Davies on the right, Leray on the left. Yeah, it's a bit inverted in attack, but I think defensively that could help you limit the Weah threat. So Buchanan, I'd say I'm pretty 50-50 on. I think I could see him starting just because of the freer role he'd have, but I think it would be a very unfair to not start Larea, and I think because of that we could maybe see Larea on the left, as we've seen at times.
Got into it a little bit there, but from David Anthony, A_Miller16, besides Davies for Adekubi, do we see the same 11 in the final, as well as your starting 11 prediction? For me, the starting 11 prediction, I would say Miller, Vittoria, Johnston at the back, sticking with a 3-5-2 as well. Davies, Osorio, Kone, Estacio with Buchanan in the midfield, and then David and Laren up top. So going Buchanan on that side rather than Larea, but I could definitely see Larea or, as you say, Hoylett getting into that lineup as well.
Yeah, I'd say pretty similar, right? Like, I think Boran's going to be in goal. The back three should be relatively similar. Kamal Miller had a very good game, it must be said.
Yeah.
We shout out on that regard. Steam Vittoria as well.
Excellent back there.
Did his job, was so solid. Alistair Johnson, so keep that. Scott Candy will be there as that emergency option if need be. In terms of wingbacks, I'd probably say Larea and Davies. Larea on the right, Davies on the left. I just threw out that last combination as something to watch, given what we know about the U.S. And then I'd say Kone, Eustachio. I'll go Osorio just because he looked to be the fitter of the two between Hoylett, but I could also see Hoylett and then David and Laren up front. So really the only questions are, is it Buchanan or is it Larea?
And third midfielder.
And is it Hoylett or Osorio as your third midfielder? And I'd say based on what we saw, I think Larea and Osorio have the edge, but I'd say Hoylett also has a pretty good shout, as of course Buchanan, of a player of his quality, is always going to have a chance.
And of course, the tantalizing question of the podcast, score prediction for the final. I'm going 2-1 USA.
How dare you? No, I'm joking. We know you have the dual passports, so really this is a win-win for you, Ben. How dare you? I'm going to go 1-0 Canada. I think it's going to be close. This might even go extra time. I would not be shocked. But I do think that Canada, look, they're incredibly motivated. I saw it firsthand in March. You saw it on the pitch yesterday. These guys want to win trophies, clearly. They're successful at club level these days, and they want to translate that to the national team. This is a great chance to finish what they started in that qualifying run, but also to start another chapter towards 2026, and winning a trophy can go a long way towards that. I think they get the job done. They win 1-0 in what's going to be a pretty tight final. I would say it wouldn't be too dissimilar to what we saw in Hamilton, just in terms of maybe Canada scores early, they ride some waves, they get a couple chances, don't ultimately get it, but they're able to see it out.
Who gets the goal?
I am going to go JD again. I think he is on fire. I think that he has shown that he is Canada's Iceman. And the fact that he got that timely finish on what was really his first clear look of the game kind of goes to show you that he's kind of riding high right now.
Look, before I dive into predictions, also, I just want to say, because we didn't really mention it in the show, like, it also has to be stated how big, I mean, obviously it's a final, it goes without saying, but just the grandeur of this occasion and what it kind of means, because it doesn't really fully sink in. You're just kind of like, it's a final, like, cool. Like, this is a final against the U.S. team that has kind of sweeped a lot of these over the last 2 years. Of course, the, you know, Gold Cup 2019 went to Mexico, but U.S. did win the double in 2021.
Yeah, they did.
They're the deepest team in CONCACAF. 17 Tier 1 players versus Canada having four.
Only one to make the round of 16 in the World Cup as well.
Yeah, they made the round of 16. They're CONCACAF's best team, performing team at the World Cup. They're at home. Yeah. They're going to be in front of probably what would, I imagine, a close to sold out stadium, given it's a final. It's Vegas.
They're always at home, though.
Well, that's it. But you have to say, like, this isn't Canada versus Mexico in the U.S. Like, this is Canada, their first final in 23 years. They're playing the host team in a, you know, in that pro U.S. environment. All of those things are huge, and I think because of that, for Canada, it's just important to recognize that what this occasion will represent for Canada. And all that to say, like, this is special. And I think Canada, the fact they head into this arguably as underdogs, hopefully that will help them.
But only slight underdogs too.
Yeah. Which is, well, I'm talking just about everything. I think if we're talking on the field, it's very close.
Yes. Yes.
If we're talking off the field, the U.S.
are clear favorites. Oh yeah. All the other factors. Like, yes. Yeah.
The home, the fans, et cetera, et cetera. But all that to say, in terms of my prediction, I'm expecting a close game. It is a final after all. And I'm expecting 1-1. It goes to penalties. And what fitting way for Canada to win their first trophy after the last year, how many times we've debated.
The penalty sagas. Wow.
After all the penalty sagas that Canada lets a few guys take them. Maybe Alfonso Davies himself pots one of them.
Wow. Redemption in the best way.
And Canada wins. Because I just say, I think it's one of those where a final like this, it's going to be cagey. Yeah. I think they maybe trade goals in the game and kind of open up for a bit. But with the narrow field, they're kind of like these are guys as well. We have to remember, like, there's winners on both teams, right? Like, there's guys like Pulisic won a Champions League final, so is Davies. Guys like Eustachio, Johnston, Borjan, all these guys are trophy winners. You can do the same for the U.S.
Tejan Buchanan's on trophies as well.
Tejan Buchanan, like, these guys are going to know what it means to play in a final, even for Canada if they haven't played in a final together.
Yeah.
So I think it's going to be a cagier game. It's going to be, you know, a lot more defensive, and then it goes to penalties. And look, I think it's something where if there's one thing we know about Canada, they'll do their research, they'll do their analysis, and hopefully they pick their penalties right on the day. And I back them on penalties because the U.S. in terms of takers, I mean, they have Pulisic, they have Balogun, and after that, I don't know what how the takers are looking. And I mean, Canada, you could say the same about Canada, but David. You got David Laren starting to score him now, even though his record was a bit all over the place before. And I'm sure that, you know, they'll put a lot of research into penalties. Right. So I back them in a penalty shootout.
And you know what? One last note before we sign off until after the final. I know that it's going to be nerve-wracking for a lot of fans. It's a final. You want to see your team win. I totally get that. But enjoy this moment because it's the first time in 23 years that anyone's going to be able to say that, hey, I watched our men's national team play in a pivotal final. And I remember when Peru made the Copa America final in 2019, and this was the year after they made their first World Cup in 36 years. They played Brazil in Brazil, pro-Brazilian crowd. Peru were the underdogs. And I remember my dad, who would have been about 17, 18 years old the last time he saw Peru play in a final. And the last time he saw Peru play in a World Cup, he was 24 years old. He was then in his late 50s, early 60s by the time he saw them in a final and at a World Cup. And, like, you could just see that the nerves were finally about. He's like, I missed feeling this way. I missed feeling nervous about a big game. So to anyone out there listening, it's going to suck when you're kind of nervous all day, but also enjoy that nervousness because it's been a while since we've been able to, I think, have that feeling as Canadian supporters. So whatever way it goes, just relish in the fact that this is finally something that we get to feel for the first time in two decades.
Alex, a follow-up for you, though. If you're to pick your first five penalty takers for Canada, pick the lineup.
Yeah, obviously it depends on who's on the field.
Of course.
But I think that it's an interesting question, Ben. But I think for me, I'd go Jonathan David lead off. Always get your best takers first. Sets the tone. Mathematically, a better chance if you score first. And David's the best Canada has. If he's still on the field at this point, you assume he is. If he's playing center back, Steven Vitoria. Phenomenal conversion rate. Just missed one of like seven this year for Chavez. Generally, he's a very good taker. You'd trust him to step up and coolly convert. Then from there, my third taker, I'd also assume he'd on the field at this point, Junior Hoilett. He's taken a few for Canada, has converted them. He's pretty calm under pressure. From there, the fourth taker kind of varies. I'd say take your pick. If Laren's on the field, go for him. If not, if Eustachio is on the field, I'd kind of trust him to take a penalty for whatever reason. You know, maybe we haven't seen him take it in a game, but I'd back him to have practiced that.
He takes free kicks and stuff, so it wouldn't be out of the realm of possibility.
No, exactly. And then last one for the redemption, the fifth taker. I think you go Alfonso Davies. It gets to a fifth taker. What better way to redemption? He comes in late, has that chance to have seen some keeper tendencies. I'd go for that. And look, I think it'd be interesting to see who else could step up. I think, I mean, Osorio's taken penalties in big games before. Doesn't have the greatest record, but I mean, he's probably someone I'd have to imagine has learned from them, especially you see what David does in training, Vitoria. I'd like to think he'll have had practice in that regard. You know, otherwise, I don't know, I just back Richie Lareda to take a darn good penalty. I don't know why. Something about him stepping up.
He's got that dog in him.
And also another option as well. I just, you know, he practiced a lot of these on the mean streets of Saint-Laurent. But Ismail Kone probably has a pretty good penalty on him as well.
That's all for episode 126 of the Northern Football Podcast, the review show for Canada's 2-0 win over Panama, and a bit of a preview for Canada-USA coming up this Sunday evening as well. Certainly a special time to be a Canadian soccer fan, especially on the men's side right now. Women's side going to be exceptionally exciting coming up as well. But that's all we've got for Alex, for Peter. I've been Ben. Thanks so much for listening.